It is indeed a cloudy day outside, and the topic this morning could be somewhat depressing as well, because we're going to have to talk about funerals. And I don't know if there is any kind of practical way that I can make this funny or somehow tell enough stories to hold your attention. So the topic this morning is a sobering one. It is one that from the beginning should cause us to think deeply about our lives, about what our estimation of the meaning of life really is. Since I've been here the past 4 years or so, I have conducted or been involved in a number of funerals. There are three that stand out in my mind. That's the funeral of Mr. Nelson Node and Mrs. Carolyn Johnson, Mrs. Carolyn King, and Mrs. Jean Leonard. These funerals stood out in my mind because of the character of the people involved, and that is not to say that all the other funerals, the people there had bad character, but the Lord has used these three funerals in my life to challenge me. You know, a funeral is a strange thing. Pastors get together and they talk about them, and I've told you some stories that I heard from other pastors about funerals. But as you no doubt have attended many funerals, have you ever stopped to think about what makes up a funeral service? What is actually happening at a funeral? I think there are at least three or four different visible elements to a funeral. One is the obvious fact of the person lying before you without life. That is the reality of death. He or she is lying there, and the mouth that once smiled will smile no more. The hands that once reached out for you no longer will reach out for you. One of the elements of the funeral is that in our country, we always bring our loved one into it. There they are, he or she, before us. And so we're faced with the visible reality of death. Another element to the average funeral is the funeral message. The preacher gets up and he opens his black book, the Bible, and he reads some Bible verses and he explains those Bible verses and applies them to the situation at hand. And then usually there's a third part of a funeral, and that is the testimonies. You and I stand up and we talk about the loved one in much the same way that Dorcas's friends in the book of Acts brought Peter the things that she had made, and they told Peter what a valuable member Dorcas had been in their faith community there, their local assembly. We do that. So we stand up, and it's a hard thing to do this, but we tearfully speak of the stories that we remember of our loved one, of those times when they did something really humorous, like the Christmas when they wrapped themselves up in Christmas paper and tried to with a gift in their arms. And they had, you know, these funny family stories that we hear. The time that Grandpa did this or built this for me. And we remember them. But somewhere hidden below all of that is the truth. You know, I've been at funerals, and I'm not referring to the three people I already mentioned, when I've wondered if what we were saying really matched up with who the person was. Maybe you've been at one of those funerals where she's lying there and someone stands up and tells about what a good wife she was, and there are 20 people that cringe because she was known to have an acid tongue and destroy her husband privately and publicly. And everyone there in the church knew it. You see, there's another fact kind of hidden below all of this, and that is the fact of the person's true character. Because when we sit in the funeral service, there are those present who know how he really treated his wife. They know how the wife really cared for her family. They know the testimony that the man had at work. Was he a hard worker? Was he honest in his business dealings? In other words, in a funeral, really, you could put it this way. What we really want in the ideal funeral is we want God's words to match the testimonies which match the truth of who that person really was. In Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 1, it says, "A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth." And that really is the point as you go down through the passage. Part of the point is that when you go to a funeral and someone says these nice things about you, if it indeed is true, wow, that is more valuable than owning the most precious perfume. And you think back into ancient days, the process to make perfume was complicated and costly. And to have that, think of the perfume that was laid at the feet of Jesus. Think of the fact that how Joseph and Mary could live off of that stuff enough to get to Egypt and back. It was valuable. And Solomon says, a good name, you know what? A good name is even more valuable than having some treasure like that. And that is why I like the funeral services of Nelson and Carolyn and Jean. They were people who I think matched, who walked the walk and didn't just talk the talk. None of us are perfect. We all know that. But these are really encouraging times when we go to a funeral like that. So, let's read this passage together, and I want you to see what Solomon is saying here. And I know starting a sermon with funerals, my homiletics teacher would cringe, but when you're preaching the Bible expositionally, you preach what's there. So let's look at this passage. We're going to read verses 1 to 14, and we're going to look at the value. Really, the title in the bulletin's not really accurate. It should be the value of godly character, not the problem with foolishness. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 1. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. The word lay it is referring to consider, ponder in his heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. Surely oppression maketh a wise man mad, or the word means unreasonable, illogical. And a gift destroyeth the heart. The gift there is referring to a bribe. Better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of fools. Say not thou, what is the cause that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, and by it there is profit to them that see the sun. For wisdom is a defense, and money is a defense. But the excellency of knowledge is that wisdom giveth life to them that have it. The idea there is that wisdom prolongs life. Consider the work of God, for who can make that straight which he hath made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider. God also hath set the one over against the other, to the end that man should find nothing after him. Now, this passage at first glance doesn't seem to have any unity to it. It seems to only be a series of statements about the value of wisdom and foolishness. And at that level, I think that that is partly true. If you look down at your Bible, you have in the first section, and I think verse 1 should be attached to verses 2 to 6, you have the house of mourning contrasted in verse 2 to the house of feasting, the house of laughter, the party house and the funeral house. Then you have in verse 7 a series of statements that talk about godly character. You have in verses 2-6 the surpassing value of godly character. You have in, if you look down at verse 7, you have the value of honesty. There's oppression that makes even a wise man illogical and a bribe that destroys character. So be honest in your business dealings and in your relationships. Avoid greed and oppression. In verse 8, you have the value of patience. It says, better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof, and the patient in spirit is better. In verse 9, you have the value of self-control. It says, be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry. In other words, control your emotion. The value of self-control. In verse 10, you have the value of focusing on the present. Look at it. Say not thou, what is the cause that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning that. And then in verses 11 down to verse 12, you have the value of wisdom and a few concluding thoughts in verses 13 and 14. So it is a list of sorts, but I think it is the value of godly character. The things that really are not just valuable in the sense that we are trying as Christians to be conformed to the image of Christ, but also that, did you know this, that the Judeo-Christian work ethic does pay off? That hard work and diligence and honesty in the end, it is profitable? I think those truths have fallen in the street in the United States of America. So let's look first of all at the whole first section there that brought up the funeral and talked about the surpassing value of godly character in general. The point here of verses 2-6 is that when you go to a funeral, there are two things it tends to force you to do. The first thing is it will cause you to think. Look down at verse 2. At the end of it, it says, for that is the end of all men. Remember, I talked about the body being there. Death is the end of all men. And verse 2 says, the living will ponder this in their heart. At the end of verse 3, it says, by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. When you and I go to a funeral, we really are faced with the reality of the brevity of life. And so, I don't know about you, but I know I sit there and I think about my own life. I think about, have you ever done this? Have you ever gone to a funeral and you think about how old they were and how old you are? And you do the math? Have you ever done that in a funeral? This is Solomon saying it's that is actually valuable. The contrast is the party house. You go there to get some good beer and to forget about your sorrows and to sing the song of fools. And you know what? You might feel better, but Solomon says that the song of fools is not as valuable as being in a funeral and mourning and thinking about their life and your life. So being in a funeral causes us to think, to ponder, to examine our own lives. And then secondly, it causes us to make distinctions. Look at the passage again. And you see here this the wisdom and the fool contrast. Verse 4 says, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. The song of fools, it's like the crackling of thorns. You have a fire outside and you put all this dry kindling wood on it and it burns and it crackles. And that's all you get out. You get warmth out of it, all right? But the picture is that it's poof, it's gone. It produces a sound just like the song of the fool. You can hear it, but there's no lasting value to it. And so as we sit in a funeral and we think, we begin to make distinctions between what is right and wrong, what was wise and what was foolish. For example, you sit in the funeral and you think about the fact that the individual, that their whole family is destroyed. That was foolish. That they made some bad choices. or you sit in the funeral and you think, wow, that is a wise man lying there. He's died and his family is well cared for because he had some wisdom with his finances. And you think this way between, and you begin to draw contrasts like that between these two characteristics. How does this happen? Let's have some illustrations of this. Well, this actually happens in God's word very clearly. People are dead and they're spoken of after their death. Turn first to Hebrews 11. Let me give you a few examples of this. You all know this passage well, the Hall of Faith. We're looking at Hebrews 11, verse 33. Hebrews 11:33 says, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead, raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And what is one of the things that all these people had in common? Verse 13, chapter 11, verse 13. These all died in faith. They are gone, but they were faithful. So this is what words that are being said about them after they're gone. And they're being used as examples for you and me to know how to live and to think about someone after they passed. It is to make distinctions. OK, these had faith and these did not. Let me ask you to turn back in your Old Testament for another example, to 2 Kings chapter 23. If you've been a student in the Bible for, you know, the first 5-10 years, you should know that 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, after each king reigns, there's a little synopsis of what their reign was like after they're dead and gone. In 2nd Kings chapter 23, verse 25, we have a synopsis of King Josiah. This is what God said about him after he was gone. And like unto him was there no king before him, that turned to the Lord with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his might, according to all the law of Moses. Neither after him arose there any like him. Wow. Would you like to have that on your gravestone? There's never been someone like this before. But there's the house of the wise, but then there's also the negative side of this. So if you just look a few more verses down, at verses 36 and 37, you have Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Zebedah, the daughter of Pedaiah of Rumah. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his fathers had done. So turn back to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. We have examples here of statements that are said after someone is dead and gone. And folks, let me encourage you. Let me really encourage you to embrace this. The next time you go to a funeral, it is a godly thing for you to do the math. It is a godly thing for you to think about what's going to be on your tombstone. It's a godly thing for you to be convicted that there are things in your life that you should do better. This is the function of the funeral service. It's for the living to be challenged and inspired by the life of an individual who's died. And I've been at both. I've been at funerals where I have grieved at the hypocrisy. And I've been at funerals where I've rejoiced at the righteous life. And I can learn lessons from both. And so can you. You can learn what to do by following a righteous example, and you can learn what not to do by seeing how evil over the years played out in an individual's life. And at the end, God is not mocked. Whatever you sow, That's what you're going to reap. And so we see that in the lives of the funeral of people when we go to funerals. So there is a value to godly character. I mean, that kind of comes to the forefront, and a wise man will think about it, and a wise man is going to make these distinctions. And then the passage goes on to list the value of all these other characteristics. First of all, look at chapter 7 again, at verse 7. It says, "Surely oppression maketh a wise man mad, and a gift destroyeth the heart." Now, this verse is an appeal to the wise man. Now, one of the key characteristics in the wisdom literature of the Old Testament is that it's always the wise man who increases his wisdom. The fool says, "I've got enough." Now, think about this, folks. Are you here today as a wise man or a fool? If you're wise, your attitude is, "Teach me more. I want to learn more." A wise man will gain wisdom. A fool have nothing to do with knowledge and wisdom. Only a rod is for the back of a fool. I mean, a fool, it's better to meet a bear, it's better to meet a bear robbed of her cubs than a fool in his folly. You can't turn him from that. I mean, these are the statements that are made in Proverbs about the fool. Now, is there hope for the fool? Yes. If there's repentance, if there's confession of sin, there can be restoration and reconciliation. But this verse, look at it again. "Surely oppression maketh a wise man unreasonable." The idea here is that oppression will even affect a wise person. It will affect their heart if they give in to greed. Say, give me an example of this. Well, there is an example in the New Testament from Galatians where Peter separated himself and started eating only with the Jews, because he started getting really proud about not wanting to look bad in front of Jewish believers who came down from Jerusalem. The problem was, when he did that, it was an attack on the nature of the gospel. Because in the nature of the gospel, it doesn't matter whether you are Jew or Gentile, everyone anywhere can be saved. Your nationality does not matter. The color of your skin, irrelevant. So when Peter did that, he was attacking the very essence of the gospel message. That's what Paul said in Galatians, and that's why Paul looked at him and rebuked him face to face, publicly. But it says in that passage in Galatians that even Barnabas was carried away in this. Barnabas, the son of encouragement. Barnabas was the individual who had so much compassion on Saul of Tarsus that when he got saved, he was willing to bring him in and be sort of an ambassador of reconciliation between Saul, who became Paul, and the church in Jerusalem. Barnabas, the man of compassion, who was willing to take John Mark on the second missionary journey when Paul was not. Even that man was carried away into this pride. It changed his character. It affected him. It says here in verse 7 that this idea of bribery and greed, it will destroy the heart of a wise person. Now, we're New Testament believers. We are bought by the blood of the Lamb. We've sung about that today. We have heaven to look forward to. But men and women, have you found it to be true that you don't face temptation because you're going to heaven? I mean, isn't it true that you and I, even though we have the Spirit of God, there is still something in us that responds, that lusts and that covets? And so we need to be on our guard. I preach to wise people this morning. Don't think that your wisdom is enough. Be on your guard and value, in the context here, it's honesty in your relationships. The kind of person that you should be and I should be is ridiculously honest. I'll give you just a small example of how I struggled with this in my own life. I was working a job where I was on second shift. That was an 11 to 7, that was a 3 to 11 shift. And when I came in, first shift was getting off, and all of the managers were starting to leave around 5 o'clock. So me and my crew were there, and they were all nice fellas. And our job was to pack certain parts in bags. And we had our stock of bags here in the warehouse, and we were a subcontractor working for a bigger warehouse, and they had their stock of bags over there. And we ran out of bags. And my boss said, look, just go over there and get a couple boxes of bags. Don't worry about it. Now, I know that was such a small thing, because he was asking me to steal. There was no intention to pay the bags back, and no one would ever find out. And you know what's going through my mind? This is such a small thing. Do I really want to go through the aggravation of saying, no, I can't do this? I mean, there's already enough aggravations. It's hard enough to try to let people know I'm not a self-righteous jerk. I'm a Christian. I'm just a regular guy who found a Savior, the only Savior. Do I really want to? And so I called my elder at my church. This is to prove that I've always been in churches for the most part with elders. I called my elder and I said, what do you think I should do? It's such a small thing. And I was just, you know, I'm trying to figure out what to do. And he said, I don't know. Very helpful. And said, okay, thanks. Hung up. And so finally, I just went to my boss and I said, look, you know, I'm not trying to be a jerk here, but it's my policy not to steal anything, even bags that cost a cent apiece. And then I appealed to him and said, look, can I go, how about if I go and buy some bags right now? I'll go to the store or I'll do this. And I tried to come up with an alternative. And he wasn't very happy. These parts have to go out and this needs to happen. And boom, you know, he blew up, powder keg. But the next day, there were new bags there. Somebody had bought them, or I don't think they took them from the other area. And that was ridiculous. It was bags. But you know what? That man trusted me because I was that ridiculous with honesty. He would give me privileges and tell me to do things that he wouldn't tell any of the other employees to do because he knew I was just so ridiculously honest. I mean, I'll give you an example. I was working. This was my policy, ridiculous honesty. So I was at another job, and it was third shift. It was a 6 o'clock at night till 3 o'clock in the morning job. No one was there. My boss was not on site. I could take long breaks or short breaks. This is just hourly work, punching the clock work. And one night I stayed out a little longer on my break. So the next day I called up my boss at work. I said, look, I just want you to know I stayed out a little longer on my break last night. And, you know, want me to make that up somehow. And he just laughed. He said, Dan, don't worry about that. I don't care if you take twice as long a break. I trust you. You just do what you need to do. That comes from being ridiculously honest. Now, are there times I made mistakes? Yes. I am not the hero of all my sermon illustrations, and you all know that. But that's how this, you know, there is. Look at it. The oppression is the idea of you're greedy and you're trying to get it over on that guy. And the bribery is it has an implication to court system and also business dealings. So it's talking about the business world and the world of justice and all the relationships and how you do it. And if you begin to bend the rules a little bit, you know what you find yourself doing after a while? You're on this slippery slope, and before long, it's not just bags you're taking, but you're siphoning gas out of something, I'm talking about a blue-collar warehouse environment. What is it like in a business or working for the government or a contractor? I mean, do people in those situations steal for their employers? And how did they end up doing that? I mean, probably started with a small thing. And you're a wise person. It could happen to you. Maybe you're here this morning, and if you were to admit it, you would say, you know what? I've been bending the rules for decades, and my life is really a mess now. My friend, you need to repent. You need to tell the Lord that you need to make some changes. There's a value to honesty. If your employees, if your customers, if they know you are ridiculously honest, they will pay more money to hire you. They will deal with you. They will value you. There's value to honesty. Secondly, if you look at your scriptures again, verse 8, better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. This is the value of patience. In the context here, it's sort of the patience to begin a project and to see it all the way through to completion. Now, one of the great things about starting churches and being involved in ministry is that you can get excited about a new project. I mean, when I first came here, year one, and I sat down and I came out with my 10-year plan. I mean, we had that big snow. Do you all remember the big snow? It was like 10 feet. No, that's an exaggeration. 3, 2. How much? 6. It wasn't 6 feet of snow. It was a lot. How much, Rick? 5 feet. Okay, that was close. Well, I was squirreled away in the parsonage, and I was doing all this. Oh, yeah, 10-year plan. Ha-ha, this is awesome. Everything I've ever learned. Excitement. But you know what? That was year one, and then year two came, and then year three came, and now year four came, and now year five. We're on year five. And you know what? It's really easy to come up with 10-year plans. I found that out. Have you found that out? Ah, I'm going to get married. Here we go. We're starting on this grand adventure. 25 years later. Wow. And that's what this is recognizing. There's this excitement, this initial excitement at the beginning. And what did Jesus say? At the beginning, you need to count the cost. Consider how much it will cost to build the tower, because you don't want to get it halfway up and then have to stop. And Solomon here is saying, no, it really is better to just patiently go and go and go and ding, you're done. And yes, it's done. It's better to even if you're not that excited at the beginning, it's better to have that patience and then to complete the project. That is very valuable. And so Paul and I discussed this through the years, and I began to realize, this is before we came here, that probably the best way to look at it is like William Carey looked at it. He said he wanted it put on his tombstone that he was God's plotter. He was a man who was a linguist, who was a scholar, who was just so talented. And in the end, he just said, I want you to think about me as a great sinner who was just able to plod, put one foot in front of another until the job was done. Now, that doesn't sound very glamorous. You can't fit that into a half-hour sitcom, and it really doesn't fit into a two-hour movie. But you know what? That, folks, those are fantasies. I hope this morning that you don't think that your life is like a movie. Because the reality is our lives most of the time are quite mundane. Wouldn't you agree with that? It's more the hero is the man who lives in under ordinary circumstances and remains faithful. That's the hero. Not the man who puts a cape on, is invincible, and fights a monster from outer space. He's invincible. Give me a break. Angels have it a lot easier than we do. We live in a world of sin, in fleshly bodies, that if somebody puts a brick 10 feet above our head and drops it on our head, we're dead. We get killed like that. We're dust. Angels, they're eternal beings that have incredible power, and they are above us in the created scheme of things. They don't die. Folks, if you're here today and you're someone who is patient, don't get discouraged. And so I came up with the statement, small, sustainable steps. Many of you have heard me say that before. But it's the idea of just plodding and getting it done. And after a few years, you look back and you go, wow, look at all we got done. But if you look back to yesterday, you'll get discouraged. If you look back a month, you'll still get discouraged. But if you look back a few years, you go, wow, we've accomplished a lot. There is value to patience. Do you believe that this morning? Or do you want to be like Tom Cruise in some movie? I won't get started on what I think of Tom Cruise, the plots that of movies he's written. So what do we see next in the scripture? Look down at your Bible again, and we see the value of self-control. It says in verse 9, be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of fools. Again, notice, it's an appeal to the wise. Wise person, do you want to be on the same level as a fool? A fool loses his temper all the time. In his heart, he's just that way. It's better to not be hasty in thy spirit, to be angry, for anger rests in a fool. Do you want to be like a fool this morning? Let me get you to turn to 1 Samuel chapter 25 and let's look at a fool real quick. 1 Samuel chapter 25. All right. Do you want to be someone who has the wisdom of a godly Bible character? Or do you want to be like this guy? 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 1. And Samuel died, and all the Israelites were gathered together and lamented him and buried him in his house at Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. And there was a man in Maon, whose possessions were in Carmel. And the man was very great, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. This is evidence that you can be a fool and be very wealthy. Fools can get money. Verse 3, now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife was Abigail. And she was a woman of good understanding and of a beautiful countenance, but the man was churlish and evil in his doings. And he was of the house of Caleb. All right, think back to the verse about oppression, greed, bribery. That fits into the category of churlish and evil in his doings. He was a man of means, he had attained great wealth, and he had probably done it on the backs of other people, dishonestly and unscrupulously. That's who he was. But he had a wonderful wife. So you know what? It's possible to be really wealthy and to have a lovely wife and to be a fool. So what happened? Verse 4, David heard in the wilderness that Nabal did shear his sheep. And David sent out 10 young men. And David said unto the young men, get you up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus shall you say to him that liveth in prosperity, peace be both to thee and peace be to thine house and peace be unto all that thou hast. And now I have heard that thou hast shearers. Now thy shepherds, which were with us, we hurt them not. Neither was there aught missing unto them all the while they were in Carmel. Ask thy young men, and they will show thee. Wherefore, let the young men find favor in thine eyes, for we come in a good day. Give, I pray thee, whatsoever cometh to thine hand unto thy servants and to thy son David. And when David's young men came, they spake to Nabal according to all those words in the name of David and ceased. And Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David and who is the son of Jesse? There be many servants nowadays that break away every man from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my flesh that I have killed for my shearers and give it unto men whom I know not whence they be? So David's young men turned their way and went again and came and told him all these sayings. Now, we need to be careful here because this looks like a protection racket. All right, you've got the thug and he goes into the shop owner's house and he says, pay up or you'll get what's coming to you. And the shop owner says, okay, and he goes into the cash register and he gets out the money. Thank you. You'll be safe this month. You know, that's not what's happening here. We know that for two reasons. One, because of the character of David that's already been demonstrated throughout 1 Samuel. The kind of man David was, it would be inconsistent with his character, and the author is pointing that out all along the way, for him just to have a protection racket where he's going to these people and saying, yo, we protected you, you pay up. And then we also have the character of Nabal that's so described in verse 3. Evil in his doings, his business doings. So there is an intentional contrast between Nabal, the fool, and David. And what is David asking for? Notice the way it is phrased in verse 8. He says, ask thy young men, and they will show thee. Wherefore, let the young men find favor in thine eyes. We come in a good day, and you're shearing your sheep, things are great. Give, I pray thee, whatsoever cometh to thine hand unto thy servants. He didn't say, pay up, and it better be X amount of money. Give it to me now. He said, look, we've been protecting your sheep. We made sure that, you know, the Philistines didn't come in and kill you all. Could we have some food? And the guy's response, who is David? Now, of course, he knew who David was. David said, ask your shepherds. Do you think the shepherds didn't come home and say, hey, Nabal, David, he protected us today. We would all have been dead. Nabal knew who he was. But the fool was unwilling to part with a little bit of food to help David. And we know there are countless fools in the Bible, right? You could probably start thinking about them. Think of Balaam, The guy is such an idiot. By the way, the Greek word idios is where we get our English word idiot from, and it's defined as concerned only with one's own self. And that really is what Balaam was. The error of Balaam was that he wanted all this money and he kept pushing his head against the brick wall God was putting in front of him. God said, no, no, no. And finally God said, all right, go ahead. Go ahead, Balaam. And then Balaam's going and God sends the angel down. And the angel's there and the donkey sees it. And the donkey stops. And then the donkey speaks to him. Have you ever had your donkey speak to you? All right, no, don't raise your hand. In a language. And he still doesn't get the message. And then his eyes are opened. Okay, God says no, I think twice. God sends an angel. God makes his donkey speak. And then lets him see the angel standing right in front of him. And he still goes. So do you want to be in the same category with Nabal and Balaam? Nabal, Balaam, Dan Fox. I don't think so. I really don't want to be in that same category. Go back to Ecclesiastes. That's the danger here. If you're someone, Ecclesiastes 7, verse 9, if you are hasty to be angry, before long, that will affect your relationships, your family, your friendships, and before long, your whole, the good name that you should have, it's going to start falling, just like a thermometer in cold weather. And then your friends and everyone's going to start accepting the fact that, you know what, that's the way that person is. They're acting like a fool. There is a value to self-control, holding in your emotion, learning when to say when and not to get angry too quickly. All right, so very quickly, look down again, because I really want to cover verse 10. The value of focusing on the present. Let me read that to you. It says, say not thou, what is the cause that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this. Again, the appeal is to someone who cares about wisdom. And it is really focusing on the fact that you and I should focus all our energy, our passion, our gifts on what's happening right now. The former days, in this case, the person is saying they were better. Look at it again, verse 10. What is the cause that the former days were better than these? Now, right now in this church and every church, you have people that have backgrounds that were worse. You could come into this building and you were abused as a child. You had a family situation that was awful. And so you look back and you say, you know what, I've got it better now. And my counsel to someone like that who's really struggling is forget the past, seal the door on it, and then move forward and focus on the present. Now, that's a little different than what's being spoken of here, because this individual is looking back and going, wow, think of how good it was in the good old days. Penny candy, do you remember that? That was great. You could go down to the Five and Dime. You could buy like a whole bag of candy for a penny. And you know what? You could go down to this restaurant and you could get a pie. Now I don't think this is saying that it's wrong to reminisce. Okay? You can buy a magazine today. It's called Reminisce. And inside of it, it has all these historical facts and things that you can think about. That is not necessarily wrong. But this is someone who's preoccupied with the good old days. Now, this would be someone who's here today, probably from the age of 40 up. I say 40 because I'm 42 and I'm already starting to get this way about the 80s. Ronald Reagan or whatever. All right. And I'm not trying to be political. But even when Bill Clinton was first, there was economic prosperity and things were better than they are today. And I think, and what's the person here asking? Look at it again. What is the cause that the former days were better than these? Now, again, this is not saying that we shouldn't hire politicians to do studies to try to figure out economically what happened in the past and replicate that today. This is more someone who is at our level, day-to-day life, we're preoccupied with reminiscing about the good old days. We're focused on that. We really wish it was like that. And I struggle with this because I love Leave It to Beaver. And I've done this. Don't laugh. I fantasized about living with Leave It to Beaver in his neighborhood, where I can let my kids walk down the street when they're 4 years old and they'll be safe. And then the neighbor will give them cake and they're not like a child molester. They're just a neighbor. You ever feel that way? Why can't we go back to Mayberry? Why can't I sit there and get my hair cut and talk about, you know, well, I can't gossip, so I have to talk about something else. I can't talk about it. Everything happening. I mean, the America we have today is so different from that, isn't it? The breakdown of the family, the rise of all different immorality in our country. And yet, we have to be careful because, men and women, the stewardship God gave us. Is it a mistake that you're alive today? Did God say, oh, I let that one slip through. He was meant to be in 1950, but, Gabriel, oh well. No. You're here by God's purpose. Do you remember what Mordecai said to Esther? Perhaps we're here for such a time as this. And Esther and Mordecai saved a people, and they could have been wringing their hands. Oh, why are we here? Why are we in captivity? Why do we have to go through all this? Oh, I'm so sick of this. Why me? Why me? Why me? They didn't do that. And they saved the lives of thousands of people. You know what you and I need to see? There's a value in focusing on the present, in getting out there and making a difference, in being evangelistic. And I, as your pastor, I will go to my grave believing in the power of the gospel. That's what we have that no one else does. The Muslims do not have the gospel. And the Muslims do not have Jesus Christ living in their hearts to give them the strength to love their enemies, to do good to those who spitefully use them and persecute them. That's what you have, and I have. So there is a value to focusing on where we are now and taking up our cross daily and following Him, of setting out this afternoon. And instead of bemoaning the way our country is, doing what's right while we have time left and breath left in our bodies. There's a value to doing that. And the conclusion of this is right down in verses 13 and 14. Consider the work of God. For who can make that straight which hath been made crooked? In the day of prosperity be joyful, but in the day of adversity consider God also hath set the one over against the other to the end that man should find nothing after him. The point here is that there is a sense in which you and I cannot change the world that God does not want changed. Maybe it is the will of God for America to be devastated in the next two decades. What will you and I do? Then again, maybe it's God's will that America will be prosperous in ways it has never been before in the next two decades. But the point is, consider the work of God, because when He bends it, can you straighten it? I mean, there is a sense in which you have to just pray, hope for the best, and do right. Raise your family for God. Love your husband. Love your wife. Love your grandkids. Be a man or a woman of integrity. Do right and leave these higher things to God and give Him the place that He deserves. So this morning, what's going to be on your tombstone? What are they going to say at your funeral? There's a real value to godly character. Do you value it this morning?